My presentation, I will talk a bit about how we can use GIS remote sensing and Bayesian inference methods for a specific development problem, which is derocking. Derocking is a land development activity which involves the reclamation of rocky areas by the removal of surface and subsurface rocks and stones through heavy equipment. The rocks in Syria are mostly limestones, but also basalts. And the idea of this process is to create new agricultural land in areas where shallow soils and excessive rockiness are the key constraint. Since the early 70s, about 500,000 hectares have been derocked in Syria, and this was often done with external funding by development agents. It has proven to be a very successful strategy in rural areas that have a severe land shortage and poor farmers, but it has some possible negative environmental effects. These slides show how the derocking process takes place in different phases. There's the initial clearing of surface rocks, then the rocks that are not moved straight away are ripped apart up to a depth of about 90 centimeters, and then they are shoved aside, and the field that is generated is then leveled, and then it becomes almost immediately ready for planting for various crops, mostly tree crops, particularly olive. And in due course, manual stone removal takes place, and plowing creates a more even seedbed. This is the project area. It is located in the Idlib Governorate, consists of two upland areas, Jebel Wastani and Jebel Zawiya, total area 2,200 square kilometers, separated by two rift-type valleys, the Gab and the Rouge Valley. There are high differences in elevation up to 800 meters. Here are some views of these Jebel Zawiya. This is the Rouge Valley, and this is a typical view of Jebel Wastani. Now, there is a particular interest in this area, first of all, because it's heavily degraded rangelands, but also it has a great value for the conservation of biodiversity and agrobiodiversity. It's also an area that has lots of historical and cultural sites, from the Byzantine period, the 3rd to the 6th century after Christ. And it is a poor area. And this is partly due to the combination of high population density in combination with a shortage of land with adequate soils for agricultural use. Despite the fact that the climate is favorable, there are no serious precipitation or temperature constraints. So this leads to many small holdings, on average 3 hectares per family, and this is not enough to support agricultural families, so there's a high reliance on off-farm income. And as a result, this area has been recognized by the government as a priority area for agricultural development and improvement of livelihoods. Now, in this process, the soil is the key to improving productivity and farm income, because that's the main limiting factor. Despite the fact that there are significant soil resources between rocks, as you can see in these limestones, there are long pockets with deep soil. And as a result, there is also a thriving soil market, where soil is moved from one location where it is available to others where it is not. Also, derocking in an informal sense already takes place on these steep slopes here. This is not done by the government, this is done by individual farmers. So, as development issues related to derocking, there are two. There's first to avoid negative environmental impacts, particularly the reduction in the diversity of the natural vegetation, the disturbance of historical, cultural, and archaeological sites by bulldozers and erosion, And the second issue is actually to attempt to target the derocking to areas with the highest suitability in order to avoid excessive wear and tear and to avoid too low soil yield. So we addressed these development issues using a two-stage approach. The first one was to do a rapid screening using GIS and remote sensing in order to identify areas that are definitely unsuitable. So this is the process of mapping unsuitability. And the second stage is to focus on these areas with some potential and do there a detailed and targeted soil characterization and use the Bayesian methods for probabilistic outscaling. So this is mapping suitability for derocking. I'll go very quickly through the first phase. It consisted essentially of compiling available secondary data, climate, soils, geology, land use, farming systems, and then produce some new data, particularly a map of lithological groups. We had to make a new base map at 50,000 scale because the existing topo maps were inadequate to show all the features of interest. A botanical survey was done to identify areas with high value for biodiversity conservation. A new land use land cover map for the entire governorate was produced, and all this was then integrated in the GIS by using certain criteria for unsuitability, and these were quite obvious. Too many rocks, too steep slopes, presence of quarries, historical ruins, build-up areas, obviously areas that were already under crops, forest, and potential to serve as conservation area. So on the basis of these criteria, we were able to exclude 85% of the entire project area as unsuitable for derocking, and only 15% was kept as perhaps having a potential for derocking and requiring further investigation. So this was the results from the first phase, the areas unsuitable for derocking, and then the mirror image is the areas with potential for derocking. The second phase had the following steps. The first one was a limited soil survey. Limited because it did not cover the entire area with potential for derocking. So we selected 30 watersheds out of the about 290 watersheds in the area with potential. And in these watersheds, soil property maps were produced by transect walks. And on the transect walks, 34 transect walks, we did augering observations and property focusing on depth, texture, color, rock percentage, rock type, and hardness class. And in addition, we had 12 soil profiles that were fully characterized and analyzed in the lab. So this is the selection of the watersheds with, in deep colors, the areas where actually soil maps, simple soil maps were produced, focusing on these five properties. At this stage, it was possible to start thinking of Bayesian statistics in order to outscale that information from the 30 watersheds to the entire area with potential for derocking. And for this, of course, we use the Bayes theorem, and that equation is well known. It shows the relationship between the posterior probability, the prior probability, and the conditional probability given certain types of evidence. The principles were to map soil properties instead of soil bodies and to have a probabilistic mapping. So instead of saying pixel X has the depth class 0 to 25 centimeters. The maps would show the probability of given depth classes. And the mapping itself is based on the weight of evidence method, first proposed by Bonham Carter and Achterberg, and modified by Corner in the Expector software. So the particular implementation of the Bayes theorem in Expector is shown in this equation, and what makes it particularly relevant for our study is that the evidence is presented in GIS format through so-called evidence layers. And the evidence layers that we used were, first of all, the soil maps of the selected, of the 30 selected watersheds, plus a soil depth map for the entire project area, which was produced using QuickBird imagery in Google Earth, the slope map of based on SRTM, the wetness index also based on SRTM, and a map of lithological materials derived from the 200,000 scale geological maps. So with these evidence layers and the Expector software, we were able to generate two kinds of probability maps, probability surfaces for each hypothesis class, soil depth and rockiness classes, and the most probable hypothesis class. So this is an example of how these probability maps look like, in this case the depth being more than 75 centimeters, and there's a small error here, it should be the most probable rockiness class. So this information, these probability maps, can now be linked to suitability. In fact, by using thresholds for suitability as they have been defined by the development agency. And these are simple enough. According to IFAD, derocking should not take place, or should take place rather, if the slope is less than 25%, if the rockiness is between 10 and 65%, and the soil depth should be more than 30 centimeters. So it is now possible with our probability maps to match these derocking suitability criteria using the thresholds. So we need the probability maps of the classes, shallow or deep, should be more distinguished two types of suitability. Primary suitability, the prime candidates for derocking, and secondary suitable. So primary suitable would be on the basis of soil depth, probability class shallow or deep should be more than 90%, and for secondary suitable, probability class shallow or deep 75 to 90%, and similarly also this should be rockiness. Primary suitable, probability class numerous more than 70%, and secondary suitable, probability class 50 to 70%. And this leads now to the last step. By linking the probability maps to the user-defined thresholds, we can do a simple reclassification and then come up with a map of the hotspots of suitability, the primary primary target areas for derocking, not too many, and the secondary target areas in orange. So summing up these areas, we came to a total primary suitable of 375 hectares, not too much, but secondary suitable, where the criteria for suitability have not been met too well, of about nearly 5,000 hectares. So to conclude, we still need to do some validation work to check out whether our results are accurate. But generally speaking, the two-stage approach offers several advantages. We are able to avoid a lot of field work in a very heterogeneous area, particularly in terms of rockiness and soil depth, by making use of a wide range of multi-thematic data. At the same time, it allows us a very good understanding of the relationships between the soil patterns, the landscapes, and the geology. And we feel that the approach using the Bayesian mapping allows for a more accurate targeting for the particular, this particular development problem. Thank you. It varies between 400 and 600, and the 80% minimum precipitation, annual precipitation would be between at least 300 millimeters. So it would be enough to grow a lot of the common field crops of the region.
And curious about the suitability of these P2 areas for viticulture, perhaps grapes. Is that a viable crop, alternative crop there?
Yes, for sure. They are already growing grapes, but mostly fruit trees, olives and cherry, and the typical crops of the region, with a preference for tree crops.
Is there any consideration given to a minimum size of an area that was suitable, meaning someone's backyard, even though it's suitable, isn't really suitable for growing large scale crops?
The resolution that we used was 20 meter, but this was basically by resampling. IFAD recommends that if the slope is more than 6%, that certain conservation measures are implemented. So that's the advantage of the government program versus the informal derocking, because on the slide that you have seen, the derocking is done on very steep slopes, but there is, of course, no conservation. It's a bit of soil mining. The rocks are kept at the sides of the fields, and often they generate additional income. They, in due course, they are chopped in finer pieces, and they are used as building materials.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Now, we have time to discuss some of the previous presenters because you might have additional questions. So we have a few minutes for questions. Are there anyone? No? Well, I might have one question for Zamir. Now, I was wondering, in terms of you used Sorgho data as input into your model, to test also your modeling results on different resolutions. And Sorgho data come at a map scale of 1 to 24,000. Of course, if you use very low resolution, 10 meter, 30 meter, 90 meter, of course, the information content within your pixels doesn't change because it depends on the resolution of your input map, which was relatively coarse, 1 to 24,000. Now, my question is, what was really the purpose of this exercise?
we are sort of engaged in this modeling, and often we find ourselves not asking the right questions. Go back to said at the end of the presentation. I sort of relate to that and resonate with that. When we do this sort of a modeling of soil, because basically it's soil modeling, if you wish. And so we're using soil modeling for some other models. So, but often we sort of, we need to, in my opinion, to go and ask these questions as to, what is the purpose that you're using this map? What's the scale? And what you're trying to predict. So once we, it's almost like we are putting constraints to the model. These are the three questions. Every model puts constraints, and we're putting our boundary conditions by asking these three questions. So the purpose of this, to answer your question, was when we make these maps, we can be more efficient if we ask these questions and then prove to the people that, well, maybe for stream flow, you don't need a map at 10 meters. Although the information was initially conceived at 10 meters, maybe 10 meters can really represent the variability, you probably don't need it. You can use 30 meters and you can get the same results.
Okay, I like to comment on that.
If you go on the other hand and you go into the soil moisture distribution, then that will be a different story, because soil moisture distribution will have a bit of more of a local variability, and you may probably need to have a 10 meter. But the use was to predict stream flow. So if somebody else wants another property, is interested in some other processes, then maybe even 5 meter may not be a good service. Maybe there's 1.5. I don't know. Just,
no, I think.
When the recasting circle, it was he input a lot of real data, measured data into the digital mapping product, so it wasn't just a
okay, that might change actually the content, because in essence, if you don't put in more information, then of course, if you rasterize and coarse product, you cannot increase the information content or the knowledge content of your map. If you add additional data, for example, and improve in essence the information content of your soil map, only then you can also increase the content of the soil information, and maybe also within higher resolution produce better output for your water simulations.
I agree with you, but let me just get back to that. Functional map, okay? Mm-hmm. I agree, it's great to represent the variability, but there's a cost when you try to represent the variability. And the way I see it is, we're trying to capture a pattern, and patterns are scale-related. If that pattern I capture at a certain scale is helping someone to make a prediction on some other venues in hydrology or ecology, then so be it. That's where I'm going to stop and then not go any further in using expensive methods or collection and whatever to represent the variability and then introduce a lot more uncertainty and noise. So I'm saying that there's a trade-off. We cannot really, variability is great, we have it, but there's a purpose for the variability. There's a pattern when you try to represent the variability. So that pattern, you know, if you want to talk about 1 to 17 million scales, it's pointless, in my opinion, to have a map that is at 10 meter pixels. It's just more than uptight. If you make it at 100 meter or even at half a square kilometer, then you see patterns. Even if you grid circle, even if you grid the stats, simply gridding stats for at 100 meters, it's a polygon. But at that scale, at 1 to 17 million, looks like a continuous map. That's what they need. If I have to go further deep now and go to 1 to 24, that's faster. It's just one big block. It's not giving me anything. So I need to get to a 5 meter resolution. So
now, I don't want to start here and dispute, but the logic might be something to consider in terms of making a fair comparison. But any other comments related to the talks and presentations that we had in this session?
Mm-hmm. So, yes. So, you used both Sergo data and you supplemented that with some point data, or I wasn't exactly clear. But you used a membership map using topographic.
Sergo was simply grid. We just gridded Sergo.
Gridded Sergo.
Yes. So it was the polygon we just converted into graphic. That's how the model requires.
Okay.
But then we went on and made the map using very active is derived from PMs at night. So I mean, it's a different approach.
So where did the property come
from? The property that when you grid it, you use R values that come from a Sol data view extension.
But you used your KSAT data was the data that you actually measured. And
yes.
Watershed scale, point scale, and from the zonders where you
that was
came up with a good measurement. And then you had also georeference points that you looked at soil depth, but you adjusted those RP values
yes.
based on measured properties.
But the soil depth but the soil depth map was a simple grid survey.
So
the KSAT values that we used for both Sergo 90 and Tassel 90 were measured.
So my question is, do you think if you had gone directly from your point values through your topographic map to a raster prediction instead of the intermediate Sergo, do you think that would change your results?
But I didn't have any values, like observations
or
something.
So you didn't take any observation? Okay.
No, I didn't have
so
any.
So
I didn't really include my property or regression.
But not for
so no, I mean, yeah, I didn't have points. So I didn't have points. But for K-sets, yes, we did have measurements for K-sets. And we were lucky to have it because the model is very sensitive.
So you applied it to the soil that you sampled, or you applied it to the topographic attributes?
What would you
where your K-set measurements were from?
From soils, in the area, in the study area.
But how did you apply those over the area? Do you see what I'm saying? Was it a some sort of, did you use topographic attributes to predict them everywhere? Or did you predict it based on, I sampled this soil
no,
is here, therefore that's the problem?
No. We apply the same because, you know, K-sets vary a lot. They're often. So, I look at all the data, and the K-sets were measured by landscape position. I did that in Athens, actually. By landscape, and I haven't shown the data yet. By landscape.
Yeah, I
stratified the data in all kinds of ways just to see whether or not I was finding any trends. I can group the K-sets based on landscape position. But what I found out was the major drive was the soil horizons. It was not that there was a lot of overlapping as far as ranges. There was noise almost. And it makes sense because when you think about it, what is the kind of material that's covering the whole area? So, but you go with depth, and it was an exponential decrease, like orders of magnitude, as you go from the top layer to the bottom. And that was the major drive of the K-sets rather than the landscape position. So, for all the soil types, we apply the same case set. Just one big, uniform, relatively uniform temperature. Did I answer your question?
That's another question.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't have a question. I just wanted to chime in after Brett's talk. You mentioned using R to apply reservoir soils. A new package just came out called the raster package, which allows you to apply random forest models, or just about any statistical model to massive raster data sets. It doesn't do the operations in memory, it does them on disk. So you can take fantastic models like that. You guys are working on parameterizing with point data and apply that to massive regions at arbitrary scales. So these are people interested in those.
There's another package that does that too, and that's the package that we actually use here. And that package is called ModelMap. It does random forest.
Tree
second recommendation. We have a 70-30 split.
My head is one thing. I didn't want to be too nitpicky, but there's quite a bit of work, specifically by Frank Harrell and some of his collaborators, on interpreting model coefficients from regression trees. It's like that where you have lots and lots of coefficient variables, and then some of their work suggests that you need upwards of maybe 20,000 observations to really get a model that you can interpret. So when you have that kind of massive collinearity, competition between variables in the selection process, I think generates some confusion.
That's why we actually looked at cause of subdividing from a data set that's testing different variables separately to predict, for example, carbon to actually reduce the data set to identify those predictors, for example, the soil stats, the vegetation plants, the geology plants, and so on. Because of the immense amount of data that causes, as you said, and I think this is very important to look at those kind of techniques that can reduce our data space and identify truly those predictor variables that have the highest predictive capabilities. And actually, it's not an easy task because often as users, we tend to pre-select. We say, well, this is the geology method being put in our model, this is not the method. But you don't go the full way or really identify the whole environmental matrices like
I'm thinking in both sides though, because we're all soil scientists here. We know what causes a lot of the variability, and so that definitely needs to play a role in variable selection. But I mean, in the end, it looks like you came up with variables that make a lot of sense. So I guess that makes.
I have a comment / question that might bridge what Brent's going and the presentation by Samir. Talking about topographic indices and the scale issue. So I had some discussion earlier in a poster in this meeting where the method of flow, the flow algorithm that you use could be different scales. You know, the D8 versus the D infinity or multiple infinity method for flow might be different, for different scales. So I was just wondering if that's something that you consider when you're selecting whether or not this variable is important at a given scale. So, in particular, Demir, you mentioned the 10-30 and 90 meter and how you're using that to model the soil properties. So did you consider different optimal flow algorithms at different scales?
No, actually, I didn't look at the land. What I was looking at when I decided to look into the pixels was the soil type. And having worked in that area, going up and down, it's dissected landscape, but the slope lines are not more than on average 100 feet. So below 90, so then you're pretty much covering 2-3 slope positions at once, so all the variability is lost. And I think that was part of the reason that the grid insert didn't do that well, because it sort of violated the landscape scale in which we have collected the data and developed these models. So that was sort of my guiding principle.
Okay.
To make that selection.
And I suspect that maybe this might show up more with something like a wetness index that shows the flow accumulation, that might be more of an issue than if you use something like slope length, which may not be as affected by the contribution of flow, but the length.
I mean, I think that there's an excellent point that you're making, and this pixel resolution is really the biggest block that we have to deal with, because there's been articles written. I don't know, the recent one that I was reading was "Where is Mountain Something?" I don't remember the title.
Where is Helen Start?
Mount Helen is something that you know the article I'm talking about, and this guy was sort of playing with the resampling of pixel size, and what was finding out was that depending on how much you vary the window at which you are resampling the pixel, there was losing variability, and he was capturing noise. So there was a trade-off that he was finding out thresholds, whether to capture noise, or some it was capturing the valley, but then he increased the pixel size, and then he lost that valley. And then when you get even further, the mountain would shift it on the passes. So this is one of the things that
very, very critical at the end. But he's going to go back to the scale. The way I see it, it's going to relate to the scale, and I barely mentioned it, but the way I see it is that, you know, when we have a product, and unfortunately sometimes the way we do the math is that we go to the legacy data. And so we are somehow tied to the scale at which the data has been generated. And if that's the case, and then we have to find what pixels suits that scale so that we can harness that variability where all the attributes are. So the test, and I think John and I had a discussion before coming here about just this specific topic. What would the problem be?
Right, it's just a happy medium, right? It's like the Goldilocks theory of how do you retain all of your variability in your legacy data, but not, and then you model that effectively, but not aggregate so much that you lose the variability.
And the thing is, there are two sides of the story. One is, you know, you want to preserve that variability, but then the second one is when you make the property maps, that the properties may not display the same variability that you captured at the component or the map scale, because the properties may be, like, you want to do the parameter in minimize. It's not going to be that, I mean, if you are a fairly uniform area, you can the position, you know, it's not going to be the map.
More address your question. I'd say from our own experience in Oregon, where we have to deal with up to 4,000 and the scale we're looking at, was that we ran TPI and witnessed it many intervals all the way to a kilometer. Because we wanted to be able to capture the movement of cold air masses to capture on one side of the inbound and outside. That's really important. A lot of the soils are hollow, whether they're cryotic or not, and the cryotic frigid rate. It's basically where's the cold air flowing from the interior, generally take the last something. And the way we can be able to capture that is by going all the way up to the 1 kilometer, even 4 kilometers.
I was going to say there are other methods that, I mean, that's one approach. People try to come up with more naturalistic methods than trying to vary the scale so much that you know, particularly in floodplain situations, minor elevation differences can affect which direction the water shifts is very big. So scaling is one of it, and it's sort of an indirect method to get to some of these. But there are other things, people come up with normalized height methods where they directly try and get, cold air here.
Yeah, so in fact, if you looked at that map, you'd see
same pattern, I'd be worried because, I mean, this is really a field validated map that we have to serve.
Well, did you see that, if you recall the top of the Sergo map that I showed that had the green outlines on the pistosols, it's just, the soil is literally stopped. Vegetation immediately changes very sharply.
Yeah.
These soils are well mapped, and we need to.
I agree.
I was just going to say I really enjoyed the last talk, and it made a whole commitment to soil change. you've been talking about it, keep the middle, tiny, you know, no-till versus conventional tillage, and that is entirely different.
That dirt does not solve it. There seem to be a lot of data at a very lower portion, and so that I'm wondering how do you account for the fact that the relationship being pulled by only some very, very high number, and they're pulling the whole relationship.
Yeah, so in the calculation of R-squared, it really does include the range of variance that you see in the predicted values. And so the R square is kind of high because the high values are fairly well predicted, but there are a lot of low values that are high as well. Yeah, the carbon in Florida ranges from almost the top 27 meters to 100% organic matter. It's a challenging model.
Okay, but thank you very much for coming. And I